Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, film editor for Las Vegas Weekly, and joining me this week is Tony Macklin, film historian and critic, author of the book Voices from the Set, and online at tonymacklin.net. Thank you for being here.
Boy, that's impressive.
You've got a lot of stuff
you.
Going on.
Thank you.
And this is the sort of year-end wrap-up edition. We're going to discuss our picks for the top 10 films of the year and see whether – I don't think we are familiar with each other's lists
no,
yet.
No, we aren't. But this is the third year we've been
doing
this. Yes.
It's a wonderful –
It's a tradition. It's a Christmas tradition.
Oh, that's so nice. We've got we've got the tree in here and everything. So why don't we just – I guess let's just dive into it. And I'll start with my number 10 pick, which is Adventureland, the coming of age, which I think was a movie that Tony did not like. He's biting his tongue.
No, I'm not. I think it really appeals to young, rather callow folk.
Ah, callow. That's it, yes. Well, I actually thought that this was – it's a coming-of-age kind of comedy drama set in the 80s with Jesse Eisenberg as a recent college grad who ends up working at the titular amusement park and falling in love with Kristen Stewart. And it is a little predictable and formulaic, but I thought it had really well-drawn characters.
The only thing I would say, Josh, is that sooner or later you have to come of age.
That's true. But, you know, people like Judd Apatow have proved that you can come of age at like 40. So, yeah, you can keep waiting. So, but I thought maybe I did identify with this movie a bit, but I thought it was really warm and sweet, and the characters were well drawn. It was well acted. It was funny, and it was the kind of movie that I wish more romantic comedies were like. So I recommend seeing it maybe if
– Oh, I recommend seeing it too.
I just you wouldn't put it on your top 10. Fair enough. All right. What is your number 10?
My 10th – one of my standards is – does a film do accomplish what it set out to do?
Right.
And my number 10 is Paranormal Activity.
Oh, all right. I like that movie.
And one shocking – this is the reason why I put it on the top 10. It cost $15,000, circa $15,000 to make. Avatar cost about $320 million.
Right.
That means this film cost about – 21,333 times less, fewer dollars than Avatar.
Yeah.
And I admire Pelly. Steven Spielberg wanted to buy the property. The film worked so well that they released it as it was. It's not a great film, but I just tip my hat to Pelly, Oren Pelly, and his independent mastery.
Yeah, I agree. I like that movie quite a bit, and I think it kind of grew on me as I thought about it more, and I liked the acting, especially the lead actress in that movie. I liked her a lot.
Featherstone.
Yeah, Katie Featherstone. I liked her a lot. My number 9 pick is, I think, a movie that we both liked, is Tyson, James Toback's documentary about Mike Tyson. And when I was looking back at the great documentaries of the year, and you always get these social issue documentaries that come up as sort of like the big award winners and top 10 list contenders. But this movie to me was more affecting and more effective than most of those films. It just was a really insightful look at a messed up, conflicted guy. And it doesn't forgive the bad stuff that he's done, but it gives you an understanding of who he is and sort of why his life has gone the way it's gone. And Toback is a really talented director. And I just thought this was really a great look into a fascinating guy. Even if you don't like sports or boxing or Tyson or any of that, which I don't, you can find a lot to be really fascinated by with this film, I think.
I had it on my best 10 list all year and it got bumped. I mean, I just – not because – not because it doesn't belong.
Just there were some other
stuff. But I just
it's
juggled films.
Yes.
What Tyson did, which is wonderful, is it gave us something – the film gave us an authenticity that we didn't realize.
Right.
It gave us a vision. It gave us a reality. And I don't think it's faked.
No,
it's just
no,
a different
all.
Side. It's pro-Tyson, but it gets at the humanity of him. And so I would put it as my – 10 A or B,
B,
but my 9th, and it at the end of the year, I mean, we struggle all year long. We think, oh, there isn't going to be enough pictures on. We have maybe four at the end of November, and then there's a rush
this deluge of new
films. And last year it was The Wrestler that came on with Mickey Rourke's outstanding performance. I think this year is a film that's only been released in big markets, Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart.
Yeah.
I really liked it. Scott Cooper's first film. He's a country singer. He channels his inner Kris Kristofferson, and I think he'll get a nomination, and I really recommend this to most people. Crazy Heart.
Crazy Heart, right, which is open. I'm not sure when it's opening. I think in mid-January.
The 22nd,
I think. Is it 22nd? There you go. Yeah. Yeah, I like Jeff Bridges' performance. I felt like it was maybe a little too the redemption of the washed-up guy kind of formula. It was a little too...
Well, one thing, when you make a film about redemption... There are only about three ways to go.
Well, yeah, sure.
He fails.
The love of a younger woman.
He succeeds, and it's. And I think that this one was not contrived. I think the ending works. Maybe it's not as satisfying as we want it to be.
Yeah.
But I think it's got an integrity to it that I appreciate.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. I just was maybe hoping for a little more from it. My number eight pick is a horror movie that unfortunately I think was highly anticipated and then not a lot of people ended up seeing. It's Drag Me to Hell, Sam Raimi's somewhat campy but I thought very fun look at a woman who makes one bad decision maybe and ends up cursed by a gypsy to get dragged to hell. Alison Lohman, I thought, gave a really good performance as a character who's kind of actually unlikable and does a lot of stupid, bad things, but is still compelling to watch. And it has a really nice balance between like campiness and humor and gore and effects. And it was just nice to see Sam Raimi get back to something simple like that after the huge Spider-Man movies, which I enjoy and which he's returning to. But it was a good, entertaining detour that not enough people went to see, I think.
I agree. We can recommend that together.
Yeah.
It doesn't make my top.
Right.
But it's a good film.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
My eighth is personal experience. Pirate Radio.
Oh,
Rock and Roll
right.
Lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Great soundtrack. One of probably my favorite actor, Bill Nye. And it's just, it goes back, unlike Faking Woodstock or whatever that film was called.
Right, yeah.
That I thought was just abysmal. This is really... rocking and it soulful, and people of my generation and inclination just go with it.
Yeah.
Pirate Radio.
I think it might be a generational thing. I liked it okay. It was inoffensive fluff, I thought, but I didn't think it.
Are you offended by fluff? What's the difference between inoffensive
fluff
and offensive fluff?
Well, I can be offended by if it feels like it's condescending or whatever. And I thought there was a genuine. There's genuine heart to it. The filmmaker clearly cares about the subject matter and the time period.
It also had a cast that was good enough to improvise, and you wouldn't even know that they were improvising. A lot of it is improvisation, and it really is creative.
Yeah. No, they do carry it. So I certainly didn't like it as much as you did, but
We don't want to leave it with that. It's a very fine
film. It's a very
film.
Fine
it's enjoyable.
Film.
I bobbed on the sea of pirate radio.
My number seven pick is a film that definitely I know a lot of people didn't see, and I'm not sure if it's out on DVD yet, but it will be. It got a very limited release in the U.S. and did not open in Vegas, but I saw it at the CineVegas Film Festival. It's an Australian film called The Square. It's a really effective, noirish thriller. It's one of those movies where the main characters find a bunch of money and they think, let's just take the money and nothing will go wrong. And of course, over the course of the film, everything possible does go wrong. And I think it's just it's relentless and it's dark and it's really well crafted. I mean, the twists and turns you won't necessarily see coming, but they all kind of add up to a really excellent climax. And it's not deep necessarily, but it's just probably the most satisfying thriller, or definitely one of the most satisfying thrillers that I saw this year. And I hope people check it out on DVD. It was a big hit in Australia, didn't do much in the US, but it will be out on DVD.
The only comment I would make, I haven't seen it yet, everything possible goes wrong? Probably not.
Well, okay. There's no, you know, the Earth doesn't explode or whatever. But
it's all not 2012.
All of their plans fall apart, right, as expected and as you want, I think, in this kind of film, but in a very, very entertaining, engrossing way.
My number seven. Are we up to seven?
We're up to seven.
My number seven is a film that I'm still percolating with. It's one of the most liberal films of the year, and I still don't know how the fair and balanced audience is going to relate to this. I think the vision of this film should absolutely appall them.
Yeah.
I love the vision of this film, and I'm talking about James Cameron's Avatar.
Okay, yeah.
Wonderful special effects, but really a vision that is ultra-liberal.
That is true, yes.
A green world. Let us have the green or blue world. Certainly not the white world, but the green or blue world.
Yeah.
And I think it's a picture that could be a classic. I'm not ready at this point to say that it is. I want to see what the audience reaction is to it. But I was impressed. Little long, little redundant. 2 hours, 41 minutes, 34 seconds. They could have at least cut the 34 seconds.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I don't, you know, I think you're right about, I didn't like this movie nearly as much as you did, but I think you're right about the political content is pretty radical. And there's been some interesting stuff written online that I've read lately about the way that this movie basically sides with the terrorists. And the big climax of this movie is you're cheering on the death of hundreds of U.S. Marines, which is pretty.
Well, they're also contracted. It's also like Blackwater.
Right. But still, I mean, I think the way it sort of inverts the traditional action movie.
I agree. I don't see the people in the red states cheering the Marines getting
right. But I mean, it seems like this has been a universally successful film. So maybe they are. They're not thinking about it in that way.
Maybe they aren't thinking. That's it.
Well, I didn't say that. But – okay, we'll leave it at that. My number six pick is another big action, science fiction, blockbuster, special effects driven film. It's J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, which I thought was, honestly, for a while, was probably my number one pick of the whole year. And I think this is a movie, unlike Avatar, that doesn't really have a lot of deeper political content or isn't really philosophical in any way, which is something that Star Trek was, the originals, the TV series, the various spin-offs and stuff. But it's really, really fun to watch. It's very exciting. It's extremely well-crafted. The action is great. The special effects are impressive and really well integrated. It's so well cast. I mean, when you're taking something beloved like this and trying to replace the original actors, J.J. Abrams does an excellent job of getting the right people in. He respects the original mythology of Star Trek, but he takes it off in his own direction. And I see no reason, nothing wrong with putting a movie on the top 10 list that does nothing more than entertain the heck out of you for 2 hours. And I think
it was one of the two films that I could most recommend to everybody.
Yeah.
I think it's a terrific movie, motion picture, just entertaining par excellence.
Absolutely.
Six? Okay. Six.
We're counting down.
Ferocious allegory. Probably the setting of more movies this year than any other setting was South Africa. And District 9 is my number six. The massive spaceship that hovers over Johannesburg, and this amateur, non-actor, Charlto Copley, is, I think, very effective in the part of the bureaucrat that gets caught up in the war between the prawns and the humans. And I think it's a really good movie.
Yeah, I agree. I don't have it on my list, but again, another movie that I can absolutely get behind the picking of this film. I think it's I thought this was better than Avatar in its handling of its messages, that it was a little more subtle. It was a little less black and white, and I appreciated that.
Avatar is not subtle. That's that is for sure.
Not, yeah.
No, this had a complexity to it.
Yeah.
That I don't think Avatar does.
Right. No, I agree. But definitely a good. And I mean, I hope that director, I mean, Neil Blomkamp, who made District 9, has a lot of potential to go on and do some really interesting, cool stuff. And I definitely look forward to seeing what he does next. My number five pick here, this may be the first one we can have a serious disagreement about, because I think this is a movie that Tony did not like at all. My number five pick is The Road. Yeah, he's making a face, which is a movie that I think has been strangely overlooked. It was talked about a lot because it had been delayed for so long, and then it was positioned in this sort of awards buzz time period, and it hasn't gotten any of that. And I think that's a shame, because I think it's an extraordinarily effective film. I think Viggo Mortensen and Cody Smit McPhee, who play the father and son, who are sort of traveling, trying to find some hope in this post-apocalyptic wasteland, I think they do an excellent job. I think the cinematography is fantastic, the way it depicts this desolation. And it's just like a bleak, uncompromising film. It's based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, and I think it does a very good job of interpreting the themes of the novel and being faithful to the source while going off in its sort of own direction and making it work as a film. So, I mean, I think this is a film that people have maybe lost sight of, and I hope they go back and check it out. But I know Tony disagrees.
If you want endless angst and endless, pointless, redundant, self-indulgent, blah, blah, blah. But read the book.
The book is good,
work of art. This is not. The Road is not. We really have a strong disagreement.
I mean, and I like the book. I read the book after seeing the movie. And I think I might even prefer the movie, but I agree with you that the book is very good, and people
I won't
read
tell
the book
people
too.
how it ended. But that little prop that they used at the end.
That one tiny thing seems to have killed the whole movie. And I don't agree. I think the ending.
No, I woke up at that point.
It's slow paced, but it has a lot of good suspense, which is expanded, I think, from the book. There are certain scenes in the book that are very brief.
Yeah, the suspense is, when is this mother going to end?
Wow. All right, well, don't listen to Tony. Go see The Road, please. I encourage you, and I'll let you take it away for your next pick.
My number five is the second film, probably the film that I could most recommend to people in the donut shop.
Yeah.
And Nina, see this, rent this. This is for you, Nina. Julie and Julia.
Wow, really?
I am not a great fan of Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
But I thought she gave the most infectious performance, and you left the theater. I left the theater with a smile on my face. Can you imagine
Tony
that?
Wow, Tony smiling. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
So Nora Ephron, it's about Julia Childs, the famous Julia Childs, and the legendary Julia Childs. I just thought it was a really entertaining, delightful motion picture.
Yeah. I thought it was fairly entertaining, but I wouldn't rate it as highly, certainly, as you did. But I did like Meryl Streep's performance, and it is certainly a crowd pleaser. I will agree with you there. My number four pick is another film that did not play in Las Vegas, and consequently, I assume very few people have seen. But if it's not available on DVD now, it will be very soon, and it came out via On Demand at the same time that it came out in theaters. It's a film called The House of the Devil by Ty West, which I saw at the Fangoria Trinity of Terrors Festival here in Vegas. And with that title, and given that it played at a Fangoria festival, you might imagine it is some sort of gory, cheapo horror movie, which it is not at all. In fact, it's a movie that I think might frustrate a lot of people who are looking for that sort of thing. It's a very much a throwback to these sort of low-budgety films of the 1980s. It's set in the early 80s, I believe. And it follows – it's a very horror movie stock plot about this college student who goes to babysit at the mysterious old house in the middle of nowhere, and something's going on. But virtually the entire film – nothing is going on, which sounds awful, but the way that the tension is built and the way that Ty West builds these characters and uses these sort of familiar horror signifiers to make you wonder what is going to happen, when is something going to happen, and it's just like building and building and building, and every moment is so well crafted, and he uses silence and sound so incredibly well, and the actors are really good, that when finally something does happen and this violence erupts, it's so shocking and cathartic and exciting. And it's just, I mean, it's a different kind of horror film, but I think if you like horror movies, you know, give it a shot. Don't get impatient with it.
How would you compare it to Paranormal Activity?
You know, it compares similarly in a way in that there's a long buildup to something happening. Stylistically, it's completely different because, like I said, it's very much a throwback. It's shot on film and it has this sort of grainy look of something like Last House on the Left, the original Last House on the Left, or things like that.
Bad title?
Well, it's an accurate title in the end. But I mean, I think the title, the luridness of the title is probably part of the style of the movie. The House of the Devil is the title. And yeah, I mean, I think that is I think that's part of the whole stylistic homage to earlier horror films. But again, I think, and if you don't like horror films,
The House of the Devil.
The House of the Devil.
Did it occur in Alaska?
No, we don't need to take cheap political pot shots.
Oh,
is
that
what?
I wasn't doing that.
No, not at all. So anyway, I don't know. This is a movie that after I saw it, I was just really wowed by. And it was sort of a random occurrence in the middle of this festival that was full of sort of cheapo horror movies. But it's really excellent. And I hope people check it out.
My number four is not The Devil's House, but it's A Flying House.
Ah, yes.
Up. The Pixar Animated Studios 10th feature, and it's a good one. And that's all I'm going to say. Up goes way up for me. I thought it did what it wanted to do. And I was surprised at it because talk about an odd couple, an old curmudgeon and a young boy who is kind of silly. And yet, for me, it did work. Up.
Yeah, it did work for me too. I think I've liked other Pixar movies better. I think WALL-E last year was probably a better film, but yeah, it's very entertaining. Pixar always does great work, and I love the talking dog in Up.
Yes.
is very,
yes,
very funny. So my number three pick is also an animated film, and what I thought was the best animated film of the year. And in a year where there's a Pixar film and Wes Anderson has made an animated film, then there's certainly a lot of competition. But my number three pick is Coraline, Henry Selick's stop-motion animated adaptation of the Neil Gaiman novel. And this is one of those movies that it's for kids in the sense that you could take your kids to see it. I mean, not maybe really young kids because it has some scary moments. But despite the fact that it's a kid's movie, it's very much just a well-crafted film regardless of your age. I think it's got something to say about sort of the loneliness of childhood and moving to a new place and not feeling like you fit in and not feeling like your parents understand
you. We're relating personally again, aren't we?
Well, but I mean, that's what movies are about. They're about, you know, having an emotional connection.
When you started to say this, I thought you were going to say Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, no, which is right. Which is Wes Anderson's film. No, I just mean that there were a lot of animated films this year that got a lot of attention, and I think this movie is the one that overall is the best of them.
I like Coraline. I think I preferred Fantastic.
Did
Mr.
you?
Fox.
See, I don't. I mean, I'm not a Wes Anderson fan.
Neither
in
am
general.
I. Neither am I.
And so Mr. Fox, it has a nice look to it, but I don't think it has heart, which, I mean, Wes Anderson films almost never do, I don't think, but. But get back to Coraline.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's Coraline, I think, is a film that does have real personality to it. It has heart. It has emotion. And it has great artistry, just like the construction of it. And a film like this, a stop-motion film, which always they take years to make, and the handcrafted stuff is just really impressive. And it's great to see Henry Selick, who made James and the Giant Peach and The Nightmare Before Christmas and hasn't done a movie in quite a while. It's great to see him come back with a film that's really good. And for any age, I think this is a movie that people should see.
My number three was a film that a lot of people hated. I remember on internet movie database, there were people saying, this is the worst film of the year. I hate this. This is. But again, for me, it does what it sets out to do, and it does it brilliantly. I love the director, and all of his work has a second level, a third level, fourth level. If you have preconceptions, you aren't going to like it. And if you don't go beyond the surface, you're not going to like it. I'm talking now about Michael Mann's Public Enemies, which I liked a lot. And I love the different levels that he has. A torture scene in the past that relates to the world today. he, the famous legendary woman in red, actually was wearing orange. And he gives that in at the Biograph Theater where Dillinger finally met his end. And what is fascinatingly ironic to me is that he has the original picture that was playing in the theater that really relates to Dillinger's life and end. Michael Mann's Public Enemies, I can't recommend it to everybody, but the people who really like the artistry of film and are willing to be interpretive, I think, will get something out of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't like it. I love Michael Mann, and I was let down, I think, by this film, but clearly he has a very personal, very distinctive style, and if you relate to that or if you are on his wavelength, then this is definitely...
Yeah, he also used graphic novel techniques, didn't he?
Did he?
Oh, yeah. The machine guns and all the...
I mean, the cinematography with the digital video was something that is obviously very important to him and that I found a little off-putting in a period film, and I think a lot of people did as well, but it's definitely... You know, he's going his own way with it. So I absolutely respect and appreciate that. My number two pick is Moon, the science fiction film with Sam Rockwell, directed by Duncan Jones. It's his first feature, and he is the son of David Bowie. Not that that is necessarily important, but is perhaps interesting. And given that most science fiction movies, I mean, we talked about Star Trek a little earlier or even Avatar, and science fiction is sort of synonymous with action movie these days, and which is not necessarily bad. I mean, both of those are good films. But I like that this is not an action movie. It's a very cerebral kind of mind-bending story with a big twist that comes about half an hour into the film or so that I won't necessarily ruin. But Sam Rockwell plays the lone man on this moon base where he's harvesting some sort of mineral that is needed for energy back on Earth. And it's just a really amazing performance by Rockwell, who is basically the only person in this film, and really plays with ideas of identity and just the kind of things that I think a lot of science fiction films don't do anymore. And I was glad to see it. So another one that I think not a lot of people saw, but I hope they check out.
I won't spend a lot of time on my two because it's on your list. It's one film that's on both of our lists.
Yeah.
Star Trek was my number two.
Oh, wow. All right.
Because I thought, again, it did what it set out to do. I could recommend it to everybody. And I really admired what Abrams did with that film.
So, yeah, absolutely.
That's my number two.
I think we can be in complete agreement on that. If people didn't see it, they absolutely should. And my number one pick is the Coen Brothers' A Serious Man. And I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan, so I think anytime they have a new film, it's likely to be on my top 10 list. But I think this is still one of their stronger efforts. I definitely liked it more than their last movie, Burn After Reading, which was kind of a fun little lark, but didn't really go beyond that for me. This movie is extremely dark. It's kind of ambiguous, which I think a lot of people may have been frustrated by, but it's based in the idea of fables, the idea of storytelling, and the idea that we can never know God or even whether God exists or what his plan might be for us, and how frustrating that can be, and how can you live your life in this sort of sea of uncertainty. It's got an excellent performance from Michael Stuhlbarg, who's a stage actor that the Coens recruited for this film, and a great sense of place, as their films always do, in 1960s Minnesota, which is where they're from. And it's funny, and it's got great characters, and it's just completely satisfying to me in terms of what the Coen brothers do. And I really enjoyed it. It's an excellent film.
Okay.
So that's my top pick.
My number one is The Hurt Locker. And the New York critics picked it as best. The Las Vegas critics picked
That's
it as
true.
Number one.
That is true.
Also, the Los Angeles critics. But what shocked me the most was the Alliance of Women Film Journalists chose it as their best film of the year. Now, I don't think it's just because it was directed by a woman.
No, it's a good film regardless.
It was the most gripping experience I had at the movies this year. I thought, again, it was a film that absolutely worked on every level that it set out for. It's about a bomb disposal unit squad in Baghdad. And it sounds, I don't want to see that because it's war and we're tired of this activity. But it is, I would think it's the picture this year that has the best chance of standing up as a classic. And Kathryn Bigelow, the director, may well be the first woman to ever win an Oscar for Best Picture.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I didn't have it on my list, but I had it on my sort of expanded potential list of things that might be on the list. And it absolutely deserved all those awards that it won. And it's really – I like the way that it's about the war, but it's not necessarily political. It's not making a statement. It's just showing you the lives of these characters, and it's suspenseful and action-oriented. And I'd be happy to see it win Best Picture, absolutely. So that's a look at what our picks are for the best films of the year. Hopefully, if you haven't seen those, it'll give you some stuff to check out on DVD and in theaters these days. And my thanks again to Tony Macklin for joining me.
Merry Christmas, Josh.
And Merry Christmas to all of our listeners. And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell.
Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right.